This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. CRISPR. Depending on whom you ask, the gene editing technology is either a savior or one of the horsemen of the apocalypse. And some people's worst fears materialized in late November when a scientist announced the birth of two babies whose DNA he had edited. Now, that claim hasn't been verified yet, but it has drawn strong and almost universal criticism. It has also prompted renewed calls for a system of guidelines and safeguards for future CRISPR research, because this is not the end of gene editing research, and we shouldn't forget that a lot of other CRISPR work was also done this year. Joining me now to recap it all is Sharon Begley. She is a senior science writer with the health news website Stat. Sharon, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me, Heather.
As someone who has been following this technology, who reports about the advances and the setbacks on an almost daily basis, how much of a surprise was this announcement in November when He Jiankui announced that he had essentially helped create gene-edited babies?
The specifics definitely landed like a bombshell. The possibility that someone, possibly a little-known someone, was going to edit embryos, human embryos, and implant them, in other words, to start pregnancies, and that babies would be born, was absolutely on everybody's radar screen and has been for several years now. In fact, the first human embryos were edited in 2015, also by a lab in China, but those embryos were not used to start pregnancies, and in fact, they were non-viable embryos. But to take the next step, to use CRISPR to edit the genomes of viable embryos, IVF embryos, and then to implant them and wait 9 months and see what happened. Everybody thought that that was coming. The scientist who did this, as you said, Dr. He, he has a lab at Southern University of Science and Technology in Shenzhen. He was not an unknown quantity, but, you know, if you had asked a dozen CRISPR experts who might do this, I don't think he would have been at the top of anybody's list.
What we know about the project so far reads like a how-not-to manual for any biomedical research, right? Questionable consent procedures for the families who are involved, an edit that, by all accounts, is relatively untested and completely unnecessary, not designer babies where, you know, cosmetic features were being changed or anything like that, but not a necessary medical change to cure a disease or anything like that. But of course, we don't actually have verification of the claims that these babies actually do carry CRISPR-created gene edits. Do we think we'll ever get that verification?
That's a good question. The bombshell landed just as the International Summit on Human Genome Editing was getting underway in Hong Kong. And by the end of that summit, 3 days later, the organizers had made a very, very strong call for an investigation and to determine whether the claim is in fact true. Now, Dr. He has said that he is protecting the privacy, the anonymity of the family, because HIV infection is the subject of terrible stigma in China as well as elsewhere, as we know.
And the edit that he introduced was ostensibly to reduce the risk of HIV transmission.
That's exactly right. And the reason he targeted that gene and chose the families that he did, the father in this case, and the father in each couple and the 7 or 8 couples who volunteered for this study, is HIV positive. So an official investigation continues in China, both by the university and by the health ministry. I would think it's not, you know, saying anything surprising to guess that those officials have quite a lot of power over Dr. He. So whether he is able to maintain the wall of silence around this family remains to be seen. But really, it's all up to the officials in China.
Well, speaking of the officials in China, there was also at least a rumor for a while that the scientist himself had actually disappeared. Do we know where he is and how this investigation is proceeding?
So, yes, in the immediate aftermath of the announcement and the genome editing summit, there were reports that he had been arrested, that he had disappeared, that he was under house arrest. That does not seem to be the case. His lab at the university has been closed. The clinical trial to edit the HIV-related genes has been shut down. But he seems to be fairly content and is just waiting for the investigation to unfold.
Well, what has been done can't be undone. It can be investigated, but not changed. But this has really pushed the need for guidelines and perhaps restrictions on access to CRISPR technology and you know, guidelines for the research, both into the public eye and really renewed the focus on it within the science community. What are some of the ideas that are coming out of this for how this type of essentially rogue research effort might be avoided in the future?
So this kind of research would not be possible, would be illegal in the United States and most of Western Europe, at least. Many other countries, including Japan, similarly have either laws or regulations that prohibit it as well. There's been a lot of discussion about whether it is, in fact, illegal in China, and that seems to be a matter of interpretation. There's a regulation that dates back more than a decade that prohibits research that would be unethical or pose other problems, but, you know, again, that's sort of in the eye of the beholder. So at the end of the Genome Editing Summit, the organizers called for instance, an international clearinghouse in which researchers would list the studies that they were undertaking, especially human ones. So that's nice. Again, it has no force of law. There have also been calls for the companies that supply some of what are called CRISPR reagents. Those are basically simply the molecules that you need to conduct CRISPR experiments. For those companies to be extra cautious about whom they are dealing with. But, you know, they already have restrictions in place. You have to be a recognized investigator. You have to be at a real place. You can't just be, you know, saying, yeah, send all that stuff to my post office box. But Dr. Ho would have cleared all those hurdles.
Sharon Begley, this whole controversy that we've been talking about comes at the end of a year of both advances and some setbacks in other CRISPR research. At STAT, you've actually created a CRISPR tracker to keep tabs on all of these many studies. I mean, the pace of research is really quite overwhelming at this point. And if we go all the way back to the beginning of this year, one of the first kind of big CRISPR studies to make headlines was news that many people may actually be immune to the CRISPR molecules, the gene editing molecules themselves, and that might severely limit the usefulness of that technology. I mean, you know, almost a year later, where does our understanding of that stand? And, you know, coming out of this recent conference, is that something that researchers are really concerned about?
Right. So that's a study that came out of Stanford. And when the researcher, who's one of the leading lights in genome editing and the use of CRISPR, made the discovery, he and his colleagues immediately published it and made it known. So, you know, kudos to them. In the ensuing, more than 10 months, they have said that although it seems that some people might have antibodies to, in particular, the cutting enzyme that is part of CRISPR, there are two things to keep in mind. One, there are other cutting enzymes. They tested the original, which is called Cas9, but in fact, since the discovery of CRISPR-Cas9 and its use as a genome editor, let's peg that as 2012, scientists have discovered just an entire menagerie of other cutting enzymes. So the bottom line is, even if people are, or some people, have an immune reaction to one enzyme, there are lots more that could be used. But more importantly, that lab at Stanford said it's probably not as big a problem as we might have originally thought.
Well, another potential obstacle that popped up this year was a study around mid-year that said something to the effect of CRISPR maybe works better in cells that don't prevent cancer as well. There was a lot of confusion about what these studies might mean. So what's the CRISPR-cancer connection?
Right. So just to take one teeny step back, the way CRISPR works is by cutting the double helix, the molecule of DNA, and that's called a double-stranded break. As you can imagine, cells don't like it when their DNA gets cut, and there's all sorts of cellular repair machinery to fix those cuts. So it turns out that cells in which a particular gene has been disabled are not able to fix those cuts, which means that CRISPR and the edits in the genome that CRISPR makes are more likely to succeed in these hobbled cells. Well, it turns out that the gene that's hobbled, that also is a cancer watchdog. So just to, you know, play this out, cells in which CRISPR works are more likely to lack breaks that would keep cancer in check. Therefore, if you CRISPR cells, they have a greater potential to become malignant, to seed, to initiate cancers.
I mean, that doesn't mean that CRISPR is causing cancer. It just means that the technique works better in cells that are already predisposed to cancer, right?
That is exactly right. And that those cells are then returned to the patient, whether it's a sickle cell patient or beta thalassemia or muscular dystrophy or any of the many diseases that are being targeted by this research, then those cells, as I say, might seed, might initiate cancer. So the thing that was notable about those studies, there were two independent studies. One came out of the Karolinska Institute in Sweden, which is probably best known for being the place that awards the Nobel Prize in medicine. The other came out of a pharmaceutical company lab, Novartis, its Institute for Biomedical Research here in Cambridge. So when you see two independent labs that really had no idea the other was asking a similar question, reaching the same conclusion, you kind of pay more attention to it. So people do not regard this as a deal breaker, but they do say that it's something that researchers and those moving toward the clinic absolutely have to be aware of.
And researchers are moving toward the clinic. I mean, there were a number of studies either in isolated cell lines in the lab or in animals this year showing potential progress in using gene editing to treat a whole range of diseases, sickle cell being one you mentioned that's been right at the top of the list of potential targets, phenylketonuria, hemophilia, Duchenne muscular dystrophy, all of those coming out with fairly positive results, right?
They have. And, you know, as you're noting, these were studies either in human cells just being grown in lab dishes, i.e. in cell culture, or in mice that had been genetically engineered to have the human form of whatever disease was being studied. I'll just throw one more in there, Heather, because it makes a point that I think is really, really fascinating. Back in June, researchers targeted Fragile X, which is this horrible, devastating brain disorder that causes mental impairment and early death. So I wrote one story that looked at whether diseases in which the brain wiring has gone, you know, completely off the rails, and Fragile X is one of them. Is there any hope for those? Because in those cases, you think you would have to reverse the brain's miswiring and then rewire it in a normal, healthy way. And that just seemed really, really hard. But an awful lot of very smart researchers told me, you know, don't write it off just yet. So in the case of Fragile X, again, this was work done in mice. CRISPR was delivered into their brains and it targeted a gene. And lo and behold, it reduced the dysfunction. It was actually exaggerated signaling between neurons. And there were behavioral consequences. The mice got better. One of the signal symptoms of Fragile X, at least in the mouse model, is repetitive behavior. And that behavior was decreased by 70%. So again, just to underline, the mice were born with miswired brains. CRISPR was able to reverse it, and somehow the mice were able to overcome what had been a terrible, life-threatening, serious brain disorder. So that suggests, you know, there are lots of things that we might have thought was beyond the reach of CRISPR, which actually might not be.
Really pretty amazing. Sharon Begley, what are the chances that we will see a CRISPR-based technology, a CRISPR-based treatment in clinical trials in 2019?
So as it happens, we already have the first CRISPR clinical trial that is backed by a U.S. company.
And what is that trial? And you're saying it's already begun?
Right. So that launched in the summer. It's backed by Vertex Pharmaceuticals and CRISPR Therapeutics, and they are testing it in the blood disorder called beta thalassemia. They're recruiting in Germany. So although it's U.S. companies, the actual clinical trial is taking place in Germany. And they're aiming to recruit a dozen adults. So, you know, we and others had been reporting that the first such clinical trial by a U.S. genome editing company would be for a form of blindness, which Editas Medicine has been aiming for. But in fact, CRISPR Therapeutics beat them to the clinic. It's an early clinical trial, as I said, just 12 adults, and they have started to recruit. No results yet, but it seems pretty likely that we'll get at least a preliminary read of the safety, at minimum, of the therapy in 2019.
Safe to say that the controversy here at the end of the year has not slowed down the pace of the rest of the field?
So the CRISPR babies, and, you know, let's just call them that because you can't avoid the hashtag. there is great concern that that will slow down these therapeutic uses of genome editing, CRISPR, and actually others as well. A number of scientists said that to me at the Hong Kong meeting, that even though the therapeutic uses of CRISPR have nothing to do with embryos, have nothing to do with babies, just the whole surround would make regulators look more critically at some of these proposed clinical trials, that the public would, you know, recoil against it, and that that would slow down these medical uses of genome editing. In all honesty, Heather, I don't see it. Polling has shown that when you ask people, if you have a child or if you have an adult who has a terrible genetic disease like sickle cell, like muscular dystrophy, and if you could take out a few of that patient's blood-making cells and use this new technology to fix the genetic defect that is causing the disease, and then you put those blood cells back and the person is cured, would you be in favor of that? The vast majority of those who are surveyed say, yes, of course, we want to cure people of a disease that is ruining their lives and probably shortening their lives.
Sharon Begley is a senior science writer with STAT, where she covers CRISPR research and much, much more. Sharon, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Coming up, cybersecurity. Is it a pipe dream? Living Lab Radio continues after a short break.